Okay, today is March 12th, 2015. This is the second interview with Peter Rickman. We are here at Memorial Library. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives, and we are interviewing Peter about the 2011 Capitol protests. So Peter, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, Peter Rickman, R-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Excellent. I'm gonna turn this up a skosh. All right, we're fine. It's picking me up fine on this side, and I'm farther away. So,
okay.
As I mentioned before we turned on the recorder, we're going to start right off with the budget repair bill, or sort of the leaking of the idea of the budget repair bill, which was, I think, the Friday before Valentine's Day.
Yeah, Thursday, Friday, something like
that.
Yeah,
so I think if you can go back in time a few years, I know you've been through a busy stretch this legislative season, but if you go back in time, say 4 years, and maybe start by your memories of hearing about that.
I'm not sure if I can remember the sort of where I was, what I was doing, when, as Governor Walker put it, they dropped the bomb. But in that period of time, there had been a group of us amongst student activists, union activists on campus who had been building towards a longer term, medium term campaign around funding of the university system and the way campus workers are treated, their role as students, neoliberalism and austerity played out in the academy. And we had planned for an action to happen on Valentine's Day. I Heart UW, we had sort of these catchy, even kitschy little phrases. I think I still have some of the cards somewhere in my house. But we were going to deliver them to Governor Walker as part of an escalating campaign around the state budget and fighting for higher funding. Because of the ongoing work that had been happening between students and workers, I remember very quickly that night after we first heard about it, a core group of activists and leaders got together and said, we have an obligation, a responsibility, and an opportunity here to take Monday's action and turn it from being about funding for the university into being about the rights of workers. I'm really proud of the work that we had done, particularly among students in sort of building this consciousness about worker rights and the role of unions and the linkage between public institutions like higher education, public higher education, and the labor movement sort of as pillars of a just and democratic society. And so that debate went really quickly. It wasn't even a debate. Everyone just sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, of course we have to. And, we got to be the leading edge. And, a number of us were obviously, TAA activists who were both students and workers. And as workers, had our rights on the line. And so immediately we swung into gear. And, I think probably the best part about what happened in that immediate lead up to the action on the 14th was that, it was sort of a flowering of leadership where if someone had an idea and it seemed pretty good, said, all right, go do it and make it happen. It wasn't like, the committee needs to review this and then we need to assign the right person and all that. It was just sort of because of the urgency of the situation, it enabled people to step up and play the role of leading through action in a way that I think is the hallmark of the, good social movements. So in any event, we turned to those who had signed our cards. We had, probably a couple thousand of these I Heart UW cards and had been working to gather them even from campuses around the state. We recorded a brief video and put that up on the internet, and it sort of, as they say, went viral, caught a lot of attention and sort of let people know about the Monday action. Of course, had a Facebook event that, again took off and had tens of thousands of people actually see it and RSVP to it. But really what made that Monday action happen was collecting the information from those who had signed the cards and just doing the, old-fashioned organizing work of calling people up and saying, we need you to come on out and who else can you bring? And so we had phone banks going throughout the weekend and just recruited extremely heavily. And then on that Saturday, some other students not attached to us decided that they wanted to have an event on the steps of the Memorial Union. And they asked me to come speak. So I did, amongst a couple others. And I remember now Mayor Soglund, then candidate and former Mayor Soglund, showed up and he said something to me. And this is not a direct quotation, obviously, more paraphrasing. He said, you know, when the Vietnam War protests really picked up, it was an event just like this, 50 people in attendance, righteous moral outrage, and earnest, passionate people saying that they were going to step up and be part of the fight, even if they weren't themselves directly attached to it because they were students in this particular case, just like in the Vietnam War protests. And he said, mark my words, this is going to be big. And you know, to this day, I give Paul credit for the power of prescience. And so it was smaller things like that event on Memorial Union Steps and the hardcore grassroots organizing work and, you know, dedicated activists, if, you know, sort of nameless activists to this point, just people believing in the fight, doing the work to build, you know, some energy and momentum towards that Monday. And so that Monday, as you know, everything was sort of coming together, we were going through the checklists of all the things that needed to happen. We had a crew of people designated to get things set down at Library Mall. I actually went up to the Capitol myself. That was one of my roles, was to go up to the Capitol and just scope out the scene, and actually give a heads up to the Capitol police to let them know, like, this is happening so that we wouldn't have any adverse incidents. And, you know, they sort of acknowledged this was happening. And a couple of the Capitol police said, look, this is touching us too. I think it's great that you're doing this. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely nervous. I remember walking up the street towards the Capitol thinking, God, what if, you know, 100 people show up, you know, a whimper, not much of a bang. And I ran into someone who I know and told him, hey, you coming to the thing? He's like, no, I'm not. I mean, do you think it's really going to do anything anyway? And I just thought to myself, I don't know. I'll get back to you about that. And so this palpable, heavy feeling of anxiety and dread and nervousness sat in me. And so when I was in the Capitol, they got word that people were getting close and said, how does it look? And they were like, looks pretty amazing. We have 2,000 people here. And I was like, wow, really? And I stepped outside the doors of the Capitol, and there were 2,000 people showing up, and I could see people in the front that I knew, you know, campus union activists, faculty, academic staff, and obviously hundreds of students and you know, activist people that I knew. But what really struck me, and I remember to this day, is seeing faces that I was like, who are these people? Just people showing up to join the fight, join the struggle. And when we came inside, it was, you know, booming loud. I mean, I'm sure there's videos that record this far better than any words that I could share about it. And you know, I addressed the crowd briefly before we went inside with a bullhorn. Went inside, you know, we're loud and raucous in the rotunda, you know, presaging a lot of what would come from there. That was sort of a center of activity. Then we marched our way up to Governor Walker's office. And, you know, I sort of expected there would be a little bit of a police presence to keep us out, but we ended up right in that hallway in the first floor east wing going into the governor's office. And we jam-packed it, and there were television cameras all around. And, you know, we had these boxes of Valentines to deliver to the governor, and we brought them and just dumped them right out after asking if the governor would come on. And obviously, the spokesperson said no. And I remember being face-to-face with the governor's spokesman. And, you know, it was pretty impossible to understand one another. So I don't even know what I said. I don't really know what he said. It was just so loud, and there was so much energy bouncing off those marble walls and the hot lights of the television cameras and all that right there. And, you know, we delivered. There's I think a fairly iconic picture of Joe Kuo, Kyle Vanden Langenberg, and me, you know, holding up these Valentines. And, I'll always remember that. Thankfully, my wife kept a copy of the newspaper from that day. It was, or the next morning, the State Journal. And that was, it was sort of a defiant moment of we're bringing the fight right to you. And it's not the people you expect. It's not the municipal workers and the teachers. It's students and workers who see themselves as part of a broader fight for social and economic justice. Truly, that's what it was. Otherwise, it never would have gotten to that point with so many non-traditional actors. And we're ready to fight you. And it's not going to be just sort of we're calling our legislators and sending them emails and hoping the legislative process works out. You know, we're playing by a different set of rules here with, you know, more militant direct action. And I think that experience and that direct confrontation and challenge actually gave people some of the sense of what needed to be done, what could be done. They had a feeling of their own power. When you have 2,000 people in that capital, and it was unprecedented at the time, and I think people had the sense that, you know, something was going to be different about this. It wasn't just a standard set of 50 regular activist types showing up and having a little protest. This was the start of a mass movement. You know, I'm probably forgetting a bunch of the details because now it's been 4 years and all that. But, you know, we ended up, after the confrontation at the governor's office, we went outside and marched around. And I think we ended up on the north exit to the Capitol. And we did a small speak out about what was going on. And, you know, I gave a mildly coherent story about why, you know, this fight mattered to me and why I was a part of it. And, you know, that it wasn't just about any one of us. It was sort of, this is a fight for the soul of Wisconsin. And that's why we were a part of this. And we weren't going to just let it be one thing. We were going to come back. And I meant every word of that. And I think people who were there meant every word of it too, when they, you know, nodded in assent and cheered. And that set the stage for the next period of time around, you know, further activity at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so 2000, roughly 2000 the first day, but it's really Tuesday that it mushrooms from 2000 to, you know, thousands and thousands of people. Well, I guess maybe just walk us through what you remember about, you know, you got done with the Monday event. You said you were coming back, so I assume mm-hmm. you plan on coming back. What are your memories of that next day?
Well, one is there was a lot going on. You know, there were buses of county and municipal workers, and in particular teachers, coming down that day to the Capitol. And setting up for big rallies to happen in the middle of the day, and then in particular at the end of the day. I don't think at that point in time any of the teacher unions from around the state had called for, you know, basically what amounted to a strike. Mm-hmm. I don't think that had happened yet for that day, but there were just tons that were showing up. And that was also the day that the Joint Finance Committee was basically doing testimony and a hearing on the budget repair bill. So you had a steady stream of people going in to do that. And I believe I registered to testify, but it was just buried amongst, you know, literally thousands of people who were there to testify on this. And I remember there being some pretty moving testimony from people about what the cuts were going to do to them, what their union meant to them, and how getting rid of this was, you know, awful for them. But it all sort of summed up into this, you know, unconscionable deviation from at least 50 years of public employee unionism in Wisconsin, and sort of a departure from the idea of Wisconsin as a state with, you know, reasonably progressive governance and recognition of the rights of workers and the importance of public institutions playing a positive role in people's lives. There was a bunch happening that day. I recall at some point in time, there were some of us, I think it was that day where we had a lot more people showing up at the TAA office, because it was sort of becoming known as a center of activism. Like, you know, we had been doing those phone banks to build for the 14th. and we just put people to work, you know, making phone calls to people to mobilize them to turn out, getting people recruited to go out into districts of legislators. And some of these were, you know, an hour plus away, recruiting people to go out into these districts. So we were consciously part of an effort to, you know, have the Capitol be a center of activity, but also to spread out, you know, into the parts of the state where we needed to build the struggle as well, too. As the day went on and the testimony kept going, I got in my head, you know, one, there's a lot of people here, and there's a pretty clear and direct confrontation with the political leadership of the state right now by ordinary, everyday people. Not just, you know, your committed activists who'd be there, but like folks that spontaneously, autonomously, you know, got themselves into the struggle, into motion. And that was not going to recede. And that there was a decent chance that that confrontation could escalate, and that it might you know, because of the Joint Finance Committee hearing and the rally happening that night, it might, you know, explode and then continue on. So I actually went home and got like a toothbrush, and I don't think I got a pillow, but I changed clothes, thinking to myself, I might be here a little bit longer. And that was, you know, sort of prescient. It wasn't like there was any intention, all right, we're going to get a bunch of people in the Capitol and we're going to occupy it. Mm-hmm. That did arise relatively spontaneously and in the moment. But, you know, I had just a sense in my head something like that might happen. And the testimony kept going in front of the, excuse me, in front of the Finance Committee. And, you know, and then they said they were going to shut it down. And there were, I don't know, probably 500 to 1,000 of us up on the fourth floor outside of the Joint Finance Committee hearing room. And when we heard this, I remember running around the fourth floor because that's where a bunch of people were. And if you know the Capitol, it's not easy to navigate your way around there. And on in one of the other large rooms on the fourth floor, that was sort of an overflow room. And there were a bunch of, you know, leaders from public employee unions in there and rank and file activists watching stuff. And when they said they were going to shut it down, I just tore around the fourth floor saying, they're shutting it down. We got to, you know, we got to go. And brought a bunch of people up towards the doors of the Finance Committee hearing room, which they'd shut and locked. And the feeling I remember there was, oh my God, it's really hot. and you know, with so many people in there, you started to get really sweaty really quickly, actually. And, you know, we were chanting and stomping around. And, you know, I don't know if I lost my voice really quickly, but one thing I remember is that, you know, from starting to lead chants, you could see other people were willing to step up and to do the same. And in a moment like that, that's actually a really big thing, because otherwise your energy can dissipate. And it just kept building and building, and more people kept showing up and filling that space. And there were some political operatives, you know, some like union political staff who were around. And, you know, in some ways, like, I think they were sort of dumbfounded by what was happening with the Act 10 thing. Weren't really sure what to do. And that's not a criticism of them, but to their credit, there's a few of them that immediately spring to mind. They snapped into action and they went and got water and brought up these cases of water so that people could, you know, one, rehydrate from all the yelling and chanting that we were doing, and also to cool off a little. And you know, it was those little things like that throughout what, you know, became the Capitol occupation that sustained people, and that always will stick out in my mind, is that in the moment people stepped up, whether it was to be chant leaders or, you know, whatever else, to bring in water to people who were right there. And it was a pretty intense sort of thing, and I don't know how it all came about, but the Assembly and Senate Democrats decided that they were going to, even if the Republicans wouldn't continue the hearings, they'd continue the hearings. And this was sort of a moment of tremendous uncertainty. And I don't know if the Capitol operations people and the Capitol police really knew what to do. So they, I think probably in hindsight, they would say maybe didn't make the right decision, but their hand was forced with so many people so angry that the Republicans were going to push through this, you know, unprecedented assault on working people without so much as even finishing the hearing and the testimony. And so they kept the Capitol open. The Democrats announced they were going to continue doing the hearing, even if it wasn't official. And anyone who was there to speak was going to be able to speak. And, you know, it just sort of was like, oh, well, I guess we're staying in. I don't think people consciously thought of it as an occupation of the Capitol at that point in time. But there was like, there was a press conference that the Democrats called, and Stephanie Bloomingdale, the Secretary Treasurer of the state AFL-CIO, who I knew and know still, came in and grabbed me and was like, these politicians are going to, you know, jump out in front of this. We have to have this be about working people who are fighting for themselves. And it just, you know, one of those things that continues to stick into my mind. And it's an ongoing thing, and, you know, amongst progressive forces about, you know, who's out front on these fights. Is it Democratic politicians, or is it activists and movement people? But that press conference happened. You know, the Democrats, to their credit, announced they were going to continue these hearings, and they went and set up. And a smaller group of us went back to room 300 Northeast, which was a room that AFT Wisconsin, the State Federation for my union at the time, TAA, had rented, or not rented, but had sort of booked. And that had then morphed its way into being, you know, protest headquarters. A smaller group of us went back there, and some senior movement leaders, union leaders, people with whom I'm actually very, very close, 60 plus years old veterans, left wing veterans of the union movement, facilitated a discussion about what are we going to do. And through the course of that, there was, it's a lot of grad students, so everyone's got to say everything at least once, and probably more than that too. And it was clear there's a consensus, like we need to continue to occupy this building, and we're going to fight and be as militant as we need to. And at one point in time, I was like, I got up and said something, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's like, look, it's clear we're going to do this. We've got hundreds of people in this Capitol right now not knowing what's going on. We need to go rally the troops. We need to exercise some leadership and tell them, we're going to stay. Are you in? And give them the confidence that there is some direction to this, and that doing what they're doing, which is outside the comfort level of any ordinary person, basically a militant occupation, is the right thing to do. If you're the housewife from Altoona who showed up because you believe in fighting for your husband's union, or you're the guy who's been getting health insurance because your nurse wife has had a good public employee job, and you want to protect that for yourself and your kids, and that's why you're protesting. What you're doing here is a legitimate thing to do. And so I remember going around into the mezzanine, where people had started to set up, and some of them had thought ahead too and brought their own pillows and whatever. We're staying. This is the right thing to do. We're gonna occupy this Capitol. And so it was a a series of things along the way, people stepping up as leaders through their activism, not because they were self-appointed or someone named them a leader, but people leading through action. Creating this situation where people were going to launch an occupation, and not just a bunch of committed radicals, but ordinary everyday people, saying this is how they were going to fight, because playing by the rules was going to leave us, basically rolled over. So it was in some ways a pretty heady way to start an occupation, and then it was ongoing throughout the night, and I remember sleeping for about an hour and a half in room 300 Northeast. We sort of had this collective decision to turn out the lights, and people who wanted to sleep could sleep. And, most of us, grabbed a, like I said, about an hour and a half of shut eye. And not a very comfortable night sleeping under a table with a bag like this for a pillow. But we were then occupying a state capitol.
And that room, became like... I've heard that room talked about as sort of the hub of activism. Also, the TAA was there, so that's the place that others have talked about as being the place that sort of becomes the room.
Yeah, it was. If the Capitol was a center of activity in this multifaceted, multi-layered Wisconsin uprising of 2011, in some ways, room 300 Northeast was the nerve center for what was happening in that center. Now, there were also things like at the Concourse Hotel, where the official union movement had a bunch of rooms, and people were set up there, and sort of proceeding on a couple of different fronts and different paths as well. But for the Capitol occupation, room 300 Northeast was it. And gradually over time, what you saw happen was that wasn't just a gathering place or a place to plug in your phone or your laptop and charge it, but food and beverage got set up in there, and then crock pots and whatnot out in the hallways, and it became part of a self-sustaining, in some ways, ecosystem. People knew that was where you go to if you wanted to bring food, or if you wanted to order pizza, or if you're a notable of some sort. Like, when you come to Madison, that's where you go to. Like, Tom Morello came in and hung out and talked to people there, and Senator Baldwin, Tammy Baldwin, came in and talked to people there. And it's like, that was sort of the place where you knew that things were happening that impacted the whole of the occupation, but it was also the place where, like, some of the most committed and early activists were sort of centered as well.
So when did you go back home? And when did you leave again, I guess?
I think that next morning I went home to once there was like a good size crowd started to gather, I went home, laid on my bed for about 45 minutes, fed the dogs, and took a shower, and I came back there. I was probably gone for about 90 minutes all told, and then back to the Capitol. Now, this is where all the days start to merge together in my mind, not just 4 years on, but as I've thought about it, like, God, I couldn't tell Wednesday apart from Thursday apart from Friday of that week, other than just knowing that at one point in time there's this tremendous surge of energy and momentum with, you know, basically like teachers calling what amounted to a statewide teacher strike.
So let's talk about a couple of things here, which might get us through the rest of our time. If not, I have obviously more to ask. So how are you? You know, as you said, this sort of all morphs into one. You know, after those initial memories, it all sort of morphs into one. But how are you balancing in general, you know, being a TA and being at the Capitol during this time? So my first direct question would be, you know, did you have a class? Did you, what was your semester like before, you know, February 11th?
I didn't go to class for the entirety of that occupation time. And I was fortunate enough to have some professors who were understanding, if not of, you know, the struggle and the fight, at least my absolute commitment to it, and they were willing to work with me. One of the classes that I was taking, extremely ironically, was a public sector labor law class, and the faculty person for that class allowed me to, you know, essentially like hold on doing my assignments, provided I was willing to, one, complete the assignments, but then also add some reflection to that. I was also a student attorney with the Neighborhood Law Project. I think it's now called the Neighborhood Law Clinic. And the faculty advisor for that, you know, sort of arranged some things with me there where the cases that I was working on, where there wasn't urgent things, I could just sort of toll the work until, you know, things became a little clearer about what was going to happen. And then with the cases where there was some urgent things, we were always in pairs, and that my paired person could take the lead on some of those. But he had this other thing too, that, like, you know, I wasn't just gonna get off whatever, but I had to write like nightly reflections and send them to him, and we can maybe get into this, but like I did sitting in the office of Representative Corey Mason, which I used as a place where some nights I slept in there because I could, you know, sort of get actual sleep in there, sleeping on the carpeted floor. Anyway, we can get into that more. But I remember doing those with the lights turned off around me and just typing away and being so exhausted that I couldn't even really think straight. But I was, you know, by God, I was going to fulfill my responsibilities because I had these understanding professors. I was not a TA at the time. I was a project assistant, which is, you know, also part of what was then the bargaining unit. And again, my employer was totally understanding and willing to sort of let things happen. Just so happened that the funder for that project that I was working on was AFSCME District Council 40, one of the, you know, large public employee unions. And so the staff leadership and my supervisor who was overseeing the project from District Council 40 showed up, you know, they were obviously there early on, and they're, you know, it was just sort of a knowing thing, like, so you're not coming in, right? Like, it's more important that you're here, and we'll figure out the rest of the project on the back end, which we did. But I was extremely fortunate that the people who were sort of part of my academic and work life at the time understood, like I said, most of them sort of, you know, down for the cause, believed in the struggle, but also just sort of understanding that I was playing a leadership role and that there was no way I was not going to continue doing that, and that I was willing to accept the consequences, and they were willing to make those consequences different than just simply a punishment kind of thing. So it was fortunate, but also as I sit here and, you know, think out loud a little, some of it is just based upon the choices that I had made as a student and whatever. Like, I put myself in a position where I was with people who were, you know, good like that. So I didn't go to work, didn't go to school for about 2.5 weeks at that point.
But in some senses, and maybe the people that were, you know, your supervisors, the faculty, the people that were sort of overseeing what would have been your work, I mean, it was an education in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is an important thing, too. At the time, you know, a number of the faculty and academic staff on campus, partly because of some of the organizing we were doing, themselves got in motion around this and, you know, did some. I remember now as the TAA, we organized basically a teach out. So instead of people doing classes, lectures, discussion sessions on campus, that they should bring them to the Capitol or bring them off campus and then bring the people who are willing amongst the students to the Capitol. And so, you know, there was a moment in time there where a number of the people in supervisory positions dealing with you know, grad student workers were part of the struggle too. And you know, I think that's what happens in these movement moments where people get caught up in what's happening in a good way, and they find themselves in the struggle and find what they can do in the struggle.
So how are you balancing then being at the Capitol and home?
I am married to a woman who is incredible in any number of different ways, which is why I was fortunate enough to be able to convince her to marry me. But she knew going into this what, you know, my commitment was going to be, and was extremely, not just understanding, but supportive, and would, you know, bring me food. And my brother lives in town, and, you know, she and he would figure out how to, you know, get me some things, or, you know, just come and be supportive. And, you know, that when there were a couple moments where we were building towards points of escalation and nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, where the risk of arrest was real, and, you know, many of us had made the decision that that was something we were willing to do, you know, she was really anxious, but also, again, very supportive and understanding of this being, you know, part of my life and part of our life together. So I couldn't have been more empowered because of the partnership with my wife. And, you know, just, you know, we had, to that point, always had just sort of, I don't want to say like difficulty in our marriage and partnership with the degree of activism I'd been involved with and the tensions it put on our time together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that had always been something of a struggle, and we were always committed to working through it and you know, still are. Mm-hmm. So it was tougher than normal, but it wasn't like it was something she wasn't used to. And, you know, just she made it easy for me. And the rest of my family was also extremely supportive too. Like I said, my brother, who doesn't necessarily have, like, certainly doesn't have any kind of left-wing politics like I do, was very supportive and said, you know, whatever you need, I'm here for you. And, you know, was great throughout. And I remember one night when I had a bag with me, and I couldn't have the bag with me because there was this moment of potential civil disobedience leading to the risk of arrest. He took it. And that's like those little things, again, that enable people to lead in the moment and create these larger, more powerful moments. My in-laws, who, when I first met them, were Fox News-watching Republicans and now are, you know, pro-union, pro-worker people to a large degree, came and joined the protests. My parents, and, you know, my mom was a public employee at the time, you know, small, soft-spoken woman from Neenah, Wisconsin, came down, and I remember her finding, we found each other, and her friend, who was a retired teacher from Menasha, found each other in the Capitol, and we stumbled upon our state representative. And my mother, all 5'6" of her, you know, went up to this guy and basically got in his face and was like, "You cannot do this." And it was this intense moment, and I just hung back and watched a lot of pride. I've never seen this sort of degree of politicization. You basically went after this guy, and he ended up being one of the people who voted against it. And I, you know, to this day, as a Republican, I think he's a decent human being. He voted the right way for the right reasons. He said, "Look, Pat, I'm voting against this." the reason I bring that up in follow-up to your question is, when things started, I was actually a little nervous about the reaction of my family, my parents, you know, sort of straight-laced conventional people. And my dad, for his part, and there's a longer backstory to this, but, you know, for the purposes of what we're doing here, he bargained for management on the other side of the table from actually what ended up being my mom's union. And he came down and protested, too. And I hadn't really talked to them a whole lot since the occupation began to that point. But it was their presence and their willingness to show up and their willingness to be, you know, activists in their own right there that just gave me a sense that, you know, not only is this, as I was convinced, the righteous thing to do and something that absolutely needed to happen and I had a role to play in it, but I was supported, you know, whether it was my wife, who's extremely supportive and even participatory in some respects because of the degree of her support, but the whole of my family was too. And these are not your, you know, left-wing trade union activists. They're normal, everyday Northeastern Wisconsin people to be part of this. And so that gave me a support system and network that was crucial for my own participation.
Well, maybe let's take a second then, since you referenced, your home representative or your mom and dad, where you grew up and your mom and dad live. So you mentioned earlier that you ended up spending some time in Representative Mason, I believe you said.
Yeah.
So how did that all come about?
I had known Corey before then. He had actually been the political director for AFT Wisconsin, and then had run for office. And we shared a number of friends in common, and so we had gotten to know each other over the preceding years and worked together on some political things. And the person who was like his lead staff person was someone I'd known for years in Madison, too. And she had actually written a letter of recommendation for me to law school. She's a graduate of the law school and actually had been one of my references for my application to the Neighborhood Law Project, and she'd been a participant in that previously. So working with the two of them, as elected official and the staff person to an elected official, I think really got what to me the role of people in those positions ought to be. It was to foster and support, frontline activists, protagonists, I guess is the term du jour, of directly affected people playing the leadership role, and that, you know, they should, as elected officials and staff people, support that. And so, you know, Corey and Vicky, Vicky Selko is her name, basically opened up their office and said, you know, if you need to sleep here, you need a place to charge your phone, you need a place to leave your bags throughout the day, 6 North is it. And so, you know, I took them up on that. And my wife brought a sleeping bag. I ended up getting it back, you know, 9 months later and left it there. But I was able to sleep in that office a number of nights throughout the occupation. And, you know, I think Corey's a wonderful human being and a great elected official. And he's a great leader because he consistently knows and understands his role to play in the movement at large. And at that point in time, his role was to, make it possible for one of the activists to do this. And at different times during the uprising, he played a different role, too. He spoke at one of the rally on that Tuesday night, right before John Nichols gave a powerful speech. So, you know, and to me, the lesson is, you know, movements have many faces, movements have many participants, and what makes them successful in the moment and over the long haul is people stepping up to play the leadership role that's appropriate at any given time. And sometimes it's stepping forward, sometimes it's stepping back, sometimes it's supporting people, and sometimes it's asking for support. And that was a great example to me of what, you know, someone could do.
So maybe just briefly then more on, since you said you didn't necessarily have to go to class, but they still asked things of you.
Mm-hmm.
So these sort of daily missives or daily reflections. I'm not asking you to recite any, but you know, sort of a basic idea of what sort of things you were writing on those days.
First person accounts of what was going on, and. You know, some degree of analysis about why those things were happening, and then analysis of the broader situation. Something to the extent of predictions about how things might continue or what might happen. And the truth is, they were really brief, because, you know, when you're only sleeping a few hours a night, and you're sleeping on, you know, in some cases marble floor, sometimes on carpet over the top of marble, you're not sleeping particularly well. So, you know, I don't know if you've ever been sleep deprived for, you know, extended period of time, more than a few days, actually, you know, your brain starts to get a little soft and fuzzy. So it's not like there was a whole lot to them more than just those basic elements and very Hemingway-esque plain sentences.
So, in one sense, this was not your, or mine, or yours, our mother's protest. By that I mean, we live in an age where, you know, you can be plugged in all the time. So it's not like the protests of the Vietnam era where, you know, you'd go home and sort of see what was on the news, or, you know, you could check the news right there in your hand. So the first question is about technology in general. How do you think technology, either personally or in general, affected what was going on in the Capitol during those days?
I think, I'm sure you've probably heard different answers to this from a bunch of different people, and I suspect that the balance of them has lauded or played up the role of technology more so than what I think is a crucial part of this. I mean, you know, I specifically referenced it before when talking about building for the 14th, that, you know, we had a Facebook event invite and heavy use of email that, you know, I think certainly helped foster some of the participation and attendance. But it was more about the buzz building and the wraparound communication to people that you know, got them to see that this was a big thing and that they should and could be part of it and wouldn't be isolated. But, you know, if there's any technological thing that mattered most during that, to me it was probably the combination of some of the things that were being posted on Facebook simply as storytelling, not necessarily as an organizing and mobilizing tool. I think that it probably helped in that respect, but it was direct first-person accounts of what was going on that sort of took on a life of their own, because people could be their own media to some extent, that enabled us to not be immediately marginalized by a traditional media that really didn't have the faculty or understanding to truly do justice to what was going on there. I think that was particularly helpful. And then also just like text messages. For me, that was big. My phone didn't work too well in the Capitol in terms of audio reception, but I could text message people, and that was a way to communicate. And, mm-hmm. you know, even though we're, you know, thousands of people in this relatively small space, you know, when you're inside the Capitol, it's pretty big. There's four wings and four floors, and it's hard to get around. So being able to communicate like that was certainly helpful. But to me, I think the most important aspect of communication was actually being in the place. And seeing people, talking to people, knowing you could go find them. It's that presence, and again, I keep referencing a center of activity that was sort of this living, breathing example of, and reality of militancy, and direct confrontation with power, and unwillingness to abide by traditional rules. And in any event, I guess to me, the role of technology was relatively secondary, more buttressing the a lot of the things that that good organizing is built on, and my experience since then, you know, working as an organizer, and this was true before this as well too, is that, you know, there's no substitute for actually talking to a person actively as opposed to passive communication through email or Facebook or whatever else. But I don't want to downplay at all the importance of the first person storytelling of what was happening. And sporadic moments where, like, a Facebook post about they're shutting down the Capitol, everyone get there, being helpful because it was immediate. Mm-hmm. You didn't have time to ramp up a phone bank and call 10,000 people. You put that out and 100 people could share it, and it created this, you know, sense of urgency on its own. But I don't think technology on its own was, like, this big mobilizer.
So maybe a couple more things for this time.
Mm-hmm.
Your memories, if any, of the 14, like when you heard that they had left, what it meant to you, if anything. It's just one of the things that sort of comes up as word association, so I wonder if you could spend a moment on that.
Yeah, that was huge. I mean, we live in a pretty passive political system here in terms of the activities of elected officials, where it's a pretty straight-laced, straightforward kind of thing where, you know, elected officials are not A, movement actors, and B, certainly confined, self-confined to parliamentary maneuvers. So the 14 leaving the state as an extra parliamentary maneuver, sort of reflecting what was happening in the Capitol and happening around the state with, you know, far less traditional modes of political engagement, was supremely important because it validated the militancy and the direct action nature of a Capitol occupation and like I said, everything else. And it put them in the same sphere as the rank and file protagonists, as engaging in what amounted to nonviolent direct action of their own. It was civil disobedience. I mean, that's why they crossed state lines, so that they couldn't be tracked down. And stories of how they made their way out of town sort of became, you know, momentary legend and lore. And I think, you know, it put trade union activists and our allies and the Democrats into a position of unity that I think oftentimes is assumed but isn't actually real. And so you had politicians taking a risk. And again, I can't underemphasize the extra parliamentary nature of it. Their willingness to basically leave the parliamentary field and cross state lines and remain there actually stalled things and created a moment not just based upon the energy and momentum being generated from this unity of activity, but also just in terms of chronology. There was enough time for more and more people to mobilize with this validation and legitimacy, which then spawned something of a nationwide thing, where you had, you know, the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor chartering a plane and bringing rank and file activists in. You had Tom Morello and the Dropkick Murphys coming in. You had union and progressive activists coming in from all over. You had cultural figures aligned with us coming in. You had Ed Schultz showing up and basically setting up broadcast, you know, a traditional media figure, and many others, putting a spotlight on what was happening, the attack on worker rights, this generational assault on unions, and the fight back that people were engaged in. The activity of the 14 Democratic senators made that possible. And that cannot be underestimated. It's the tactical things that amount to a larger strategy that sort of evolves on the ground. That was incredible. And then you could look to those Democratic senators as playing a leadership role in their own right. Now, I think there's also a lot of conflict with the nature of Democratic politicians and sort of the roles that they end up playing or parlay that momentary, you know, correct and heroic activity into something else over the long haul. But, you know, in the moment, that was so crucial and it can never be underestimated. And like I said, it was truly heroic because they took a risk. They put themselves in the line. They opened themselves up to their own recalls because of that, mm-hmm. In addition to the withering criticism of the right wing and even some more traditional media who simply does not understand extra parliamentary maneuvering in our political system. It was absolutely crucial and a really important part of everything that was happening. It wasn't just a thing unto itself. It intersected with everything else that was going on in the Capitol and around the state.
Again, an understanding, as you said, that these things, after that initial sort of flurry of memory, all sort of meld into one. You mentioned earlier that just now that those senators leaving put themselves up to possibly being recalled. Do you recall during this period when the idea of recall of Republican senators and eventually the recall, possible recall of the governor, do you recall when you started hearing about that?
I recall vaguely this idea coming forward, and this is an utter misconception about how this all eventually played out, so I want to make sure to touch on that. But I remember the idea coming out from some of the political operatives from the official union movement trying to think about, you know, how do we carry this forward? And it wasn't like, oh, well, let's channel all this movement activity into the bourgeois electoral arena, as some Marxist critics from this campus have tried to levy. It was just sort of looking around, like, what can we do to escalate this? And the idea was to cease playing by the rules of those who have constructed a system that allow them to take away the rights of workers under color of law. And no one had really done recalls before, certainly not on such a large scale. And so this idea, amongst others, was out there. And the truth is, it started to percolate around those who were at the Capitol and activists from across the state, and it took on a currency of its own where people were like, yeah, this makes sense. This is something we ought to do. This is exciting. We can, each one of us can continue the fight. If I can't occupy the state capitol indefinitely, you know, and no one knew it was going to be, you know, 17 days at that point in time, this is something I can go and participate in. This is a role that I can play in the movement, and the movement itself can have a political character that translates into effective change, not just symbolic protest, but substantive change. And so it became something that that I think from the moment it was hatched, it wasn't presaged that this was something that was going to be the way forward, but it took on a currency amongst activists. And I'll say this, there were a number of tactical and strategic options on the table, and I was at that time an elected vice president of the AFT Wisconsin State Federation. And we had a vote on our executive committee. I participated by phone, and I remember where I was standing to try to sort of be inside. But because of my cell phone reception, I had to sort of be outside, and it was extremely cold. I remember standing where I was to participate in the phone conference. We had a vote on whether the state fed was going to call for a strike of all the units, of all the locals. And, you know, I argued for calling for a strike and working with other unions to do that. And the rank and file leadership of the union disagreed. Like, you know, the vote went down and there was maybe one or two other people who voted with me in favor of a strike. But that's the nature of unionism, is that tactical options are considered and the member leaders make the decisions. So it's not like recall was foisted upon people as the only way. It was put forward as one potential option amongst a number of others. And in that moment, people seeing extra parliamentary and parliamentary action as more complementary than divergent. And so, you know, this took on a currency. And the national union types were wary. They saw it as something that could work, but also something that could blow up in our face. They were concerned about what was happening in other states. They didn't quite get the whole thing because it's legally, you know, and it's rooting in the state statute. It's not something that most people are familiar with. It's, again, it's sort of off the wall, out of bounds of normal political activity, even parliamentary political activity. But it was embraced by the rank and file, the grassroots of the movement. And over the course of the next period of time, people embraced that and took it up as a thing that they could do themselves. And it was truly led by grassroots activists and ordinary everyday people. We ran canvases out of the TAA office to go get this set up. But, you know, that was one example of probably dozens of sort of self-directed things. And some of the progressive, the infrastructure of progressive forces, you know, Democratic and Labor and other progressive allies, their organizations, you know, provided some guidance and support to make that thing work. But it was entirely grassroots driven throughout. Throughout the decision making about the initial round of recalls and gathering the signatures and all that. And obviously, you know, things couldn't happen immediately with Scott Walker the way they could with the state senators. But there was another period of time with a lot of hemming and hawing and decision making about what to do in terms of recalling Scott Walker, whether to do so, when to do so, etc. And, you know, in my mind, as, you know, something of a first person participant observer, it, you know, directly contradicts a lot of those who would critique from the left the turn towards doing recalls as a, you know, as an actual strategy, political or otherwise. But I think I know who originally birthed the idea, and because of looking into this. But I just want to continue to underscore the point that this is something that was embraced and taken up by the grassroots, not just as an idea, but then put into action. And that's your best validator of tactical choices, is do the people take it up? And the people took it up.
Um, we had a couple more minutes here.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about, I'm sure we'll talk more about the 17 days next time along with then sort of looking ahead to recalls, but I want to make sure I get your thoughts on this since this is the root of the topic today. Your memories of the vote when the Senate voted.
After the 14 had come back?
When they sort of decoupled, or whatever you want to call it, when they stripped away enough of the bill that they were able to vote on it without a quorum.
I have virtually no recollection of it other than people trying to be in the lobby of the Senate chambers and trying to block the doors and all that kind of stuff. But it's one of those things that my memory is blurred from because there were a number of parliamentary activities happening in terms of the Democrats holding it in the assembly where they're wearing their orange shirts for 64 hours or something like that. Like, I have no recollection of that happening as it went down. I have no recollection of exactly when that conference committee thing happened where Peter Barca sort of stormed off and blew things up because of the process. I remember that they happened, and obviously now looking back 4 years on, I have certain images in my head, but of the times when those things were happening, that's just more that sort of blurs in my mind. I can pick out other specific instances of things happening that we probably will never get to because they're so minimally important. But I really couldn't tell you anything about that. Other than it pissed me off.
So maybe to end, and you just sort of mentioned the fact that there you have these micro memories, if you will, of events. But now that we've been talking for almost an hour, are there things about those 17 days that are specific in your mind that you want to make sure sort of get on the record, if you will?
Sure. I have these memories of Jesse Jackson showing up, and I'm like a Jesse Jackson fan because I'm a student of political history and his 1984 and 1988 presidential campaigns and what was happening with the Rainbow Coalition are like, in my mind, sort of seminal moments in progressive politics. And so Jesse Jackson showing up, oh my God, this is huge. Not just because he's Jesse Jackson, but because of the role that he's played in left-wing progressive politics. But also a number of, because I'm a trade unionist at heart. Like, I'm a person of labor. So when Rich Trumka showed up, the president of the National AFL-CIO, that was like a big deal. That was a huge validator. And like some of the national staff were like, they set up this meeting between us. And it was really cool to be like, oh, you're a person that Rich Trumka wants to talk to. And I had on, I have this Buffalo plaid checked flannel jacket, and I had a blaze orange winter hat on. It's like, it's sort of like this, Northwoods look. That there's this great picture of after the meeting that he and I had, I'm wearing this, and we carry to the Capitol these trays, these huge commercial, culinary operation trays of brats that people from the building trades had been cooking. We carried them into the Capitol to feed the people, me and Rich Trumka, and a bunch of other people, but like it's those hilarious moments. And then the national president of the international president of the United Steelworkers, which is a union that has not just a special place in my heart, but an importance to my life because of who they represent in the Fox Valley where I grew up, the paper workers, and it just their history and tradition as a union. Like Leo Girard, the president, wanted to meet me, and I had a chance to meet him. And in the course of doing that, it was just like, oh my God, this guy's totally a hero to me, and he's here and he's joining our fight. I don't know if this name has come up, but there's a fellow that lived in Madison at the time. His name's Ed Sadlowski, and he worked for AFSCME. Before that, he'd worked for MTI. In between, he had worked out in California for a union there. Ed Sadlowski is the son of oil can Eddie Sadlowski. And with a name like Sadlowski, he's Polish, and I'm Polish, but you can't tell from my last name, because it's my dad's. But my family's from Poland, off the boat. And Oil Can Eddie had led this insurgent rank and file at uprising in the steelworkers in the 70s, and he showed up to, you know, to be part of the fight, and supporting, you know, his son Ed, who is a staff rep and all that. And I got to meet, you know, Oil Can Eddie Sadlowski. This is a, you know, rank and file union activist who made big waves, and was sort of one of those people who, if the union movement had followed, I don't think we'd be in the position that we're in today. So, you know, I got to meet some of these amazing people, who showed up there to be part of the struggle, and like at a certain currency of being a person they wanted to talk to and meet. And that was just a really heady moment. So those are some of the things that stick out to me, because they're like, you know, they're very personal and all that. but, you know, if I sat here and thought about it and just yammered on for a while, which I guess is the nature of oral history, right? I could probably come up with 100 other things that were just like amazing moments that happened in the Capitol. Oh, like the first time the firefighters marched in and came into the rotunda, and James Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa's kid, marched with them and, you know, gave this big speech to the people in the rotunda. And like, it's hard to hear, but he had a microphone and there was a speaker there, and I held the speaker on my shoulder for Jimmy Hoffa to give a speech right after this powerful, compelling, emotional moment when the firefighters marched in with their bagpipes. So it's things like that. Oh, Mary Kay Henry, the president of SEA, who now I've gotten to know much more, came to show her support and spoke at a rally and had a rank and file SEIU activist speak at one of the rallies. And she came in to do a thing in the rotunda, and I like did this introduction for her. And it was this really amazing moment. You had thousands of people in the rotunda, and I got to introduce her to them. And she gave like a really cool speech about, you know, being there to support people and encouraging them to keep up the fight and all that. And I spoke at one of the big rallies too, one of the big, you know, 50, 75, 80,000 people rallies. And I think I did a pretty good job with that. It was the first Saturday of that. And that'll always like be in my mind as like, an important and good moment. My wife apparently has a video of it somewhere, but I've never actually asked her to see it. I'm not that narcissist. So anyway, you know, dozens, hundreds of small little things like that that sort of emerged in this incredible moment, that to even sit here and talk about it sort of befuddles me. Like, oh my God, did that really happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, that should, or that will, I guess, wrap it up for the day. So, Peter, thank you very much for your time. This concludes a follow-up interview with Peter Rickman.